Dorothy Sarnoff is one of the world's top speech and image consultants. Her clients have included George Shultz, Robert Dole, Menachem Begin, Jimmy Carter, and Leslie Stahl. I'm interested in her because one of her specialties is coaching politicians, celebrities, and authors for radio and television interviews. I know I've interviewed some of her clients. Now Sarnoff has a new book. It's called Never Be Nervous Again, and it's time for her to be the talk show guest. We invited her to speak to us from the NPR Bureau in New York, and I asked her to explain what she does for her clients.
I'm like one-stop shopping for a person. Where does he get his ideas? How does he make them come across better? How does he write them better? What kind of style does he have when he delivers? What are his behaviors when he's all the behaviors when he's communicating with others, including how does he look? How does he dress? Or how does she dress? I'm in the business of little things mean a lot. Everything gives a message about us.
I want to tell you some things I've encountered from my end of the microphone and see how you handle it and what it indicates from your perspective.
Interesting.
Now, when I interview people, I frequently find that there are two extremes in the length of answers that they give. Some people will give, like, one-word answers. Very frustrating for an interviewer.
Horrible. You don't have time to say, well, what do I ask next?
And then the other frustration is if someone is into this endless stream of consciousness that won't stop until you interrupt. They could go on for 10 or 15 minutes if you'd let them. How do you suggest to people to pace themselves in their answers when they're going to be interviewed?
To feel the rhythm of how that conversation goes back and forth. Some answers can be short, but not too short. One-word answers are too short. The whole thing goes out of balance. And maybe limit themselves to three or four sentences otherwise.
Now, I've noticed a lot, and I've noticed this for years, that many guests who have, for instance, written a book want to let the listeners know that they've written this book, and so some of them will start every new thought with the phrase, as I say in my book titled blah, blah, blah.
Well, can you blame them?
Well, do you teach them to do that?
That's why they're there, really, to let the world know about their book.
Well, what do you tell authors who are going to be doing interviews about how many times to mention their book?
Well, we say no more than three, depending on the length of the interview. But we say you have to be able to say the title so fast that the interviewer doesn't mind it. So if you say Never Be Nervous Again, now you're not going to mind it, as if I said, in Never Be Nervous Again, I show you how to control nervousness in any situation. It depends on how it comes out.
I tip my hat to you. You just very cleverly managed to interject the title of your book twice.
Wasn't that smart?
Yes. Now, you also suggest to people who are going to be interviewed that they know the 10 main points that they want to make in an interview. What's the reason for that?
I'm going to make a little correction to one word.
Okay.
It's not the 10 main points, but what 10 things do you not want to leave the air without having left behind because they will do something for whatever it is you're there to persuade the public about? We're all on air for a purpose, aren't we? Guests. So you have to prepare, well, if she asks me something that it can lead into something that I can say that's important for my purpose, if it's my book or it's my whatever I'm going to do, if I'm running for office, I'm going to find a way to deflect into one of those 10 things that I think is important to have on the air.
Now, you've just hit on a tremendous source of frustration for me as an interviewer. Very frequently, I will ask a question, and a guest will launch off into an answer that is making a point I know they want to give that has nothing to do with the question I've asked. So I, of course, have to re-ask it again until they finally are willing to answer the question.
Well, they should answer the question. And if they can make a segue that is natural into something, one of those 10 things, they should do it. It's not quite deflecting. You don't ignore the question.
Did you make a list of 10 points you'd like to get across in this interview?
No, I did not. But I did look at my list. If I just take a look at the table of contents in the book, that's my list. So I take a look at that.
Have we gotten to any of your points yet that you wanted to make?
No.
You also suggest to people who are going to be interviewed that they make a list of the 10 most hostile questions that an interviewer might ask them. What's the purpose for that?
Well, I've seen people have their staffs ask them hostile questions in review. That doesn't work because your staff will never be as threatening to you as you can be to yourself by saying, oh, God, that question's going to throw me. Well, take those questions that could throw you and try different kinds of answers so that you kind of experiment with questions. And if you don't prepare for hostile questions, you're not ready to go on air.
In your book, you give something that you call four positive vibes that make a commanding speaker. And vibe number two is sincerity, credibility, and concern. And you say, I've worked with politicians long enough to know that they must seem to be credible.
Oh, yes.
How do you teach someone to seem to be credible?
They have to talk with conviction. Now, what is conviction? Have you ever thought about what sounds like conviction? It's mostly using energy when you talk, isn't it? If you think about it, if I talk to you this way, I'm not going to come across with conviction. I'm not going to seem credible. I'm not going to seem sincere. So I have to teach them to talk with energy. But also, one of the most important actions is, what are the eyes doing when they're talking? Because that's where we are looking for credibility and sincerity. So I have to show them how to use their eyes when they're talking. Now, if they do those behaviors, they will seem to be sincere and credible.
I guess what interests me is the difference between seeming to be sincere and credible and actually being sincere and credible. And do you know what I mean? If you're teaching someone how to seem it, you know, it becomes theater as opposed to actual credibility.
Well, let me say this about theater. A good actor is, a bad actor seems like. So if I teach them good enough seeming so that it is as they speak, that will work. Because after all, you and I know that politicians are not always telling the truth, are they? We've seen it lately.
But you're teaching them how to look like they're telling the truth, even if they're not.
Well, I don't know whether they're telling the truth or not.
And that's not relevant to you either.
No. My job is to teach them the behavior of how to come across so that they reach out to you and that you want to reach back to them.
Do you ever despair of the fact, though, that what with television having so much impact on political image, that we're voting for people, so many Americans are voting for people based on how they seem to appear, based on how credible they look, as opposed to what their records really say?
Absolutely true. It's too sad, isn't it? We really should know. Well, here's how I feel, to start at the beginning. I feel that we should only have people up there running for office who have had experience in governing in some part of the government. Therefore, I don't feel somebody should come from outside who's an evangelist or who's a businessman and run for office. Secondly, I want to have testimony of his wisdom and judgment. Has he shown good wisdom and judgment before? I want a record to go on. I don't want him to learn in the White House.
Let me ask you, what kind of reaction do you get from media people who are interviewers and program hosts on radio and television? Do they see you as their ally, usually in helping make guests look better, or as the opposition in a way because you're training guests how to circumvent their tough questions?
Well, let me go back to something. When you were growing up, did your mother teach you how to behave at the table?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a way, I'm mama to a lot of people who go on television to show them to behave in a way that is persuasive and will further their cause. I don't really want anybody to be deceitful when they're on with a message. I have turned down many candidates.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you honestly that I turned down Ferraro.
Really? How come?
I just felt that she had an arrogance. When she did the debate with Bush, do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That made her not likable. I didn't feel that I could work with her, so I have turned down many.
So she didn't have the right raw material for you.
That's right. I have to love my clients.
Since you teach your clients how to be interviewed, when you are interviewed, do you feel like you have to be the model interviewee?
I guess I should be, but I'm not always. I make my mistakes, too. I will say, though, that clients who have come to me because they've been nervous on interviews, and we do get rid of it for them. But I myself, since I put my formula together, have never been nervous, not even talking with you.
Dorothy Sarnoff, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. And you're a toughie, but I loved it.
Dorothy Sarnoff's new book, Never Be Nervous Again, is published by Crown. This is Fresh Air.